has not been directly tested in the psychology lab. We do know that when people, and for that matter, monkeys, are joined in a positive-sum game requiring them to collaborate in order to achieve a goal that benefits them both, hostile tensions can dissolve. Chapter 8. We also know that exchange in the real world can be a lucrative positive-sum game. But we don't know whether exchange itself reduces hostile tensions. As far as I know, in the vast literature on empathy and cooperation and aggression, no one has tested whether people who have consummated a mutually profitable exchange are less likely to shock each other or to spike each other's food with three-alarm hot sauce. I suspect that among researchers, gentle commerce is just not a sexy idea. Cultural and intellectual elites have always felt superior to business people, and it doesn't occur to them to credit mere merchants with something as noble as peace. Feminization. Depending on how you look at it, the late Tsutomu Yamaguchi is either the world's luckiest man or the world's unluckiest man. Yamaguchi survived the atomic blast at Hiroshima, but then made an unfortunate choice as to where to go to flee the devastation. Nagasaki. He survived that blast as well and lived another 65 years, passing away in 2010, at the age of 93. A man who survived the only two nuclear strikes in history deserves our respectful attention. And before he died, he offered a prescription for peace in the nuclear age. The only people who should be allowed to govern countries with nuclear weapons are mothers, those who are still breastfeeding their babies. Yamaguchi was invoking the most fundamental empirical generalization about violence, that it is mainly committed by men. From the time they are boys, males play more violently than females, fantasize more about violence, consume more violent entertainment, commit the lion's share of violent crimes, take more delight in punishment and revenge, take more foolish risks in aggressive attacks, vote for more warlike policies and leaders, and plan and carry out almost all the wars and genocides. Chapters 2, 3, 7, and 8. Even when the sexes overlap and the difference between their averages is small, the difference can decide a close election or set off a spiral of belligerence in which each side has to be a bit more bellicose than the other. Historically, women have taken the leadership in pacifist and humanitarian movements out of proportion to their influence in other political institutions of the time. And recent decades, in which women and their interests have had an unprecedented influence in all walks of life, are also the decades in which wars between developed states became increasingly unthinkable. Chapters 5 and 7. James Sheehan's characterization of the post-war transformation of the mission of the European state from military prowess to cradle-to-grave nurturance is almost a caricature of traditional gender roles. Yamaguchi's exact prescription, of course, can be debated. George Shultz recalls that when he told Margaret Thatcher in 1986 that he had stood by as Ronald Reagan suggested to Mikhail Gorbachev that they abolish nuclear weapons, she clobbered him with her handbag. But Yamaguchi might reply, Thatcher's own children were already grown up, and in any case her views were tuned to a world that was run by men. Since the world's nuclear states will not all be governed by women any time soon, let alone by nursing mothers, we will never know whether Yamaguchi's prescription is right. But he had a point when he speculated that a more feminized world is a more peaceful world. Female-friendly values may be expected to reduce violence because of the psychological legacy of the basic biological difference between the sexes, namely that males have more of an incentive to compete for sexual access to females, while females have more of an incentive to stay away from risks that would make their children orphans. Zero-sum competition, whether it takes the form of the contests for women in tribal and knightly societies, or the contests for honor, status, dominance, and glory in modern ones, is more a man's obsession than a woman's. Suppose that in the pacifist's dilemma, some portion of the rewards of victory and the costs of defeat, say 80%, consists of the swelling and bruising of the male ego. And suppose that the choices are now made by female actors, so these psychic payoffs are reduced accordingly. Now peace is more tempting than victory, and war more costly than defeat. The pacifist option wins hands down. The reversal would be even more dramatic if we adjusted the war cell to reflect a greater cost of violent conflict to women than to men. To be sure, a shift from male to female influence in decision-making may not be completely exogenous. In a society in which rapacious invaders may swoop in at any moment, the costs of defeat to both sexes can be catastrophic, and anything short of the most truculent martial values may be suicidal. A female-tilted value system may be a luxury enjoyed by a society that is already safe from predatory invasion, but a relative tilt in power toward women's interests can also be caused by exogenous forces that have nothing to do with violence. In traditional societies, one of these forces is living arrangements. Women are better off in societies in which they stay with their birth family under the wing of their fathers and brothers, and their husbands are visitors, than in societies in which they move in with their husband's clan and are dominated by their husbands and his kin. Chapter 7. In modern societies, the exogenous forces include technological and economic advances that freed women from chronic child-rearing and domestic duties, such as store-bought food, labor-saving devices, contraception, longer lifespans, and the shift to an information economy. Societies in which women get a better deal, both traditional and modern, tend to be societies that have less organized violence. Chapter 8. This is obvious enough in the tribes and chiefdoms that literally go to war to abduct women or avenge past abductions, such as the Yanomamo and the Homeric Greeks, chapters 1 and 2. But it may also be seen among contemporary countries in the contrast between the low levels of political and judicial violence in the uber-feminist democracies of Western Europe and the high levels in the genital-cutting, adulterous stoning, burqa-cladding Sharia states of Islamic Africa and Asia. Chapter 6. Feminization need not consist of women literally wielding more power in decisions on whether to go to war. It can also consist in a society moving away from a culture of manly honor, with its approval of violent retaliation for insults, toughening of boys through physical punishment, and veneration of martial glory. Chapter 8. This has been the trend in the democracies of Europe and the developed world, and in the bluer states of America, chapters 3 and 7. Several conservative scholars have ruefully suggested to me that the modern West has been dimmed by the loss of virtues like bravery and valor, and the ascendancy of materialism, frivolity, decadence, and effeminacy. Now, I have been assuming that violence is always a bad thing, except when it prevents greater violence. But these men are correct that this is a value judgment and that no logical argument inherently favors peace over honor and glory. But I would think that the potential victims of all this manliness deserve a say in this discussion, and they may not agree that their lives and limbs are a price worth paying for the glorification of masculine virtues. Feminization is a pacifying development for yet another reason. Social and sexual arrangements that favor the interests of women tend to drain the swamps where violent male-male competition proliferates. One of these arrangements is marriage, in which men commit themselves to investing in the children they sire rather than competing with each other for sexual opportunities. Getting married reduces men's testosterone and their likelihood of living a life of crime. And we saw that American homicide rates plunged in the marriage-happy 1940s and 1950s, rose in the marriage-delaying 1960s and 1970s, and remain high in African-American communities that have particularly low rates of marriage. Chapter 3. Another swamp drainer is equality in numbers. Unpoliced all-male social milieus, such as the cowboy and mining camps of the American frontier, are almost always violent. Chapter 3. The West was wild because it was young men who went there, while the young women stayed behind in the East. But societies can become stacked with males for a more sinister reason, namely that their female counterparts were aborted or killed at birth. In an article called "A Surplus of Men, A Deficit of Peace," the political scientists Valerie Hudson and Andrea Den Boer show that the traditional killing of baby girls in China has long resulted in large numbers of unattached men. They are always poor men because the richer ones attract the scarce women. These bare branches, as they are called in China, congregate in gangs of drifters who brawl and duel among themselves and rob and terrorize settled populations. They can even grow into armies that menace local or national governments. A leader can clamp down on the gangs by violent repression, or he can try to co-opt them, which usually requires adapting a macho ruling philosophy that is congenial to their mores. Best of all, he can export their destructive energy by sending them to other territories as migrant workers, colonists, or soldiers. When the leaders of rival countries all try to dispose of their excess men, the result can be a grinding war of attrition. As Hudson and Den Boer put it, each society has plenty of bare branches to spare in such a conflict, and the respective governments might be happy to spare them. Traditional gynocide, joined in the 1980s by the female abortion industry, injected a bolus of excess males into the population structures of Afghanistan, Bangladesh, China, Pakistan, and parts of India, Chapter 7. These surpluses of men bode poorly for the immediate prospects of peace and democracy in those regions. Over the longer term, the sex ratio may eventually be rebalanced by the feminist and humanitarian concern with the right of female fetuses to take their first breath, together with political leaders finally grasping the demographic arithmetic and enhancing the incentives to raise daughters. The resulting boon for baby girls would translate into less violent societies. But until the first 50-50 cohorts are born and grow up, those societies may be in for a bumpy ride. A society's respect for the interests of women has one more connection to its rate of violence. Violence is a problem not just of too many males, but of too many young males. At least two large studies have suggested that countries with a larger proportion of young men are more likely to fight interstate and civil wars. Chapter 6. A population pyramid with a thick base of young people is dangerous, not just because young men like to raise hell, and in bottom-heavy societies will outnumber their more prudent elders. It's also dangerous because these young men are likely to be deprived of status and mates. The sclerotic economies of countries in the developing world cannot nimbly put a youth bulge to work, leaving many of the men unemployed or underemployed. And if the society has a degree of official or de facto polygyny, with many young women being usurped by older or richer men, the surfeit of marginalized young people will turn into a surfeit of marginalized young men. These men have nothing to lose, and may find work and meaning in militias, warlord gangs, and terrorist cells. Chapter 6. The title Sex and War sounds like the ultimate guy bait, but this recent book is a manifesto for the empowerment of women. The reproductive biologist Malcolm Potts, writing with the political scientist Martha Campbell and the journalist Thomas Hayden, has amassed evidence that when women are given access to contraception and the freedom to marry on their own terms, they have fewer offspring than when the men of their societies force them to be baby factories. And that, in turn, means that their country's populations will be less distended by a thick slab of young people at the bottom. Contrary to an earlier understanding, a country does not have to become affluent before its rate of population growth comes down. Potts and his co-authors argue that giving women more control over their reproductive capacity, always the contested territory in the biological battle of the sexes, may be the single most effective way of reducing violence in the dangerous parts of the world today. But this empowerment often must proceed in the teeth of opposition from traditional men who want to preserve their control over female reproduction, and from religious institutions that oppose contraception and abortion. Several varieties of feminization, then, direct political empowerment, the deflation of manly honor, the promotion of marriage on women's terms, the right of girls to be born, and women's control over their own reproduction, have been forces in the decline of violence. The parts of the world that lag in this historical march are the parts that lag in the decline of violence. But worldwide polling data show that even in the most benighted countries, there is considerable pent-up demand for female empowerment, and many international organizations are committed to hurrying it along. Chapters 6 and 7. These are hopeful signs in the long term, if not the immediate term, for further reductions in violent conflict in the world. The expanding circle. The last two pacifying forces scramble the psychological payoffs of violence. The first is the expansion of the circle of sympathy. Suppose that living in a more cosmopolitan society, one that puts us in contact with a diverse sample of other people and invites us to take their points of view, changes our emotional response to their well-being. Imagine taking this change to its logical conclusion. Our own well-being and theirs have become so intermingled that we literally love our enemies and feel their pain. Our potential adversaries' payoffs would simply be summed with our own, and vice versa, and pacifism would become overwhelmingly preferable to aggression. Of course, a perfect fusion of the interests of every living human is an unattainable nirvana. But smaller increments in the valuation of other people's interests, say a susceptibility to pangs of guilt when thinking about enslaving, torturing, or annihilating others, could shift the likelihood of aggressing against them. We have seen evidence for both links in this causal chain. Exogenous events that expanded opportunities for perspective-taking, and a psychological response that turns perspective-taking into sympathy. Chapters 4 and 9. Beginning in the 17th century, technological advances in publishing and transportation created a republic of letters and a reading revolution in which the seeds of the humanitarian revolution took root. Chapter 4. More people read books, including fiction that led them to inhabit the minds of other people, and satire that led them to question their society's norms. Vivid depictions of the suffering wrought by slavery, sadistic punishments, war, and cruelty to children and animals preceded the reforms that outlawed or reduced those practices. Though chronology does not prove causation, the laboratory studies showing that hearing or reading a first-person narrative can enhance people's sympathy for the narrator at least make it plausible. Chapter 9. Literacy, urbanization, mobility, and access to mass media continued their rise in the 19th and 20th centuries, and in the second half of the 20th, a global village began to emerge that made people even more aware of others unlike themselves. Chapters 5 and 7. Just as the Republic of Letters and the Reading Revolution helped to kindle the humanitarian revolution of the 18th century, the Global Village and the Electronics Revolution may have helped along the long peace, new peace, and rights revolutions of the 20th. Though we cannot prove the common observation that media coverage accelerated the civil rights movement, anti-war sentiment, and the fall of communism, the prospective sympathy studies are suggestive, and we saw several statistical links between the cosmopolitan mixing of peoples and the endorsement of humanistic values. Chapters 7 and 9. The escalator of reason. The expanding circle and the escalator of reason are powered by some of the same exogenous causes, particularly literacy, cosmopolitanism, and education. And their pacifying effect may be depicted by the same fusion of interests in the pacifist's dilemma. But the expanding circle, as I have been using the term, and the escalator of reason are conceptually distinct. Chapter 9. The first involves occupying another person's vantage point and imagining his or her emotions as if they were one's own. The second involves ascending to an Olympian, super-rational vantage point, the perspective of eternity, the view from nowhere, and considering one's own interests and another person's as equivalent. The escalator of reason has an additional exogenous source, the nature of reality, with its logical relationships and empirical facts that are independent of the psychological makeup of the thinkers who attempt to grasp them. As humans have honed the institutions of knowledge and reason, and purged superstitions and inconsistencies from their systems of belief, certain conclusions were bound to follow. Just as when one masters the laws of arithmetic, certain sums and products are bound to follow. Chapters 4 and 9. And in many cases, the conclusions are ones that led people to commit fewer acts of violence. Throughout the book, we have seen the beneficial consequences of an application of reason to human affairs. At various times in history, superstitious killings, such as inhuman sacrifice, witch hunts, blood libels, inquisitions, and ethnic scapegoating, fell away as the factual assumptions on which they rested crumbled under the scrutiny of a more intellectually sophisticated populace. Chapter 4. Carefully reasoned briefs against slavery, despotism, torture, religious persecution, cruelty to animals, harshness to children, violence against women, frivolous wars, and the persecution of homosexuals were not just hot air, but entered into the decisions of the people and institutions who attended to the arguments and implemented reforms. Chapters 4 and 7. Of course, it's not always easy to distinguish empathy from reason, the heart from the head, but the limited reach of empathy, with its affinity for people like us and people close to us, suggests that empathy needs the universalizing boost of reason to bring about changes in policies and norms that actually reduce violence in the world. Chapter 9. These changes include not just legal prohibitions against acts of violence, but institutions that are engineered to reduce the temptations of violence. Among these wonkish contraptions are democratic government, the Kantian safeguards against war, reconciliation movements in the developing world, nonviolent resistance movements, international peacekeeping operations, the crime prevention reforms and civilizing offensives of the 1990s, and tactics of containment, sanctions, and wary engagement designed to give national leaders more options than just the game of chicken that led to the First World War, or the appeasement that led to the Second. Chapters 3 to 8. A broader effect of the escalator of reason, albeit one with many stalls, reversals, and holdouts, is the movement away from tribalism, authority, and purity in moral systems, and toward humanism, classical liberalism, autonomy, and human rights. Chapter 9. A humanistic value system, which privileges human flourishings as the ultimate good, is a product of reason because it can be justified. It can be mutually agreed upon by any community of thinkers who value their own interests and are engaged in reasoned negotiation, whereas communal and authoritarian values are parochial to a tribe or hierarchy. Chapters 4 and 9. When cosmopolitan currents bring a diverse people into discussion, when freedom of speech allows the discussion to go where it pleases, and when history's failed experiments are held up to the light, the evidence suggests that value systems evolve in the direction of liberal humanism. Chapters 4 to 9. We saw this in the recent decline of totalitarian ideologies and the genocides and wars they ignited. And we saw it in the contagion of the rights revolutions, when the indefensibility of oppressing racial minorities was generalized to the oppression of women, children, homosexuals, and animals. Chapter 7. We saw it as well in the way that these revolutions eventually swept up the conservatives who first opposed them. The exception that proves the rule is the insular societies that are starved of ideas from the rest of the world and muzzled by governmental and clerical repression of the press. These are also the societies that most stubbornly resist humanism and cling to their tribal, authoritarian, and religious ideologies. Chapter 6. But even these societies may not be able to withstand the liberalizing currents of the new electronic republic of letters forever. The metaphor of an escalator, with its implication of directionality superimposed on the random walk of ideological fashion, may seem Whiggish and presentist and historically naive. Yet it is a kind of Whig history that is supported by the facts. We saw that many liberalizing reforms that originated in Western Europe or on the American coasts have been emulated, after a time lag, by the more conservative parts of the world. Chapters 4, 6, and 7. And we saw correlations and even a causal relation or two between a well-developed ability to reason and a receptiveness to cooperation, democracy, classical liberalism, and nonviolence. Chapter 9. Reflections. The decline of violence may be the most significant and least appreciated development in the history of our species. Its implications touch the core of our beliefs and values. For what could be more fundamental than an understanding of whether the human condition, over the course of its history, has gotten steadily better, steadily worse, or has not changed? Hanging in the balance are conceptions of a fall from innocence, of the moral authority of religious scripture and hierarchy, of the innate wickedness or benevolence of human nature, of the forces that drive history, and of the moral valuation of nature, community, tradition, emotion, reason, and science. My attempt to document and explain declines of violence has filled many pages, and this is not the place to fill many more in exploring their implications. But I will end with two reflections on what one might take away from the historical decline of violence. The first concerns the way we should view modernity, the transformation of human life by science, technology, and reason, with the attendant diminishment of custom, faith, community, traditional authority, and embeddedness in nature. A loathing of modernity is one of the great constants of contemporary social criticism. Whether the nostalgia is for small-town intimacy, ecological sustainability, communitarian solidarity, family values, religious faith, primitive communism, or harmony with the rhythms of nature, everyone longs to turn back the clock. What has technology given us, they say, but alienation, despoilation, social pathology, the loss of meaning, and a consumer culture that is destroying the planet to give us McMansions, SUVs, and reality television? Lamentations of a fall from Eden have a long history in intellectual life, as the historian Arthur Herman has shown in The Idea of Decline in Western History. And ever since the 1970s, when romantic nostalgia became the conventional wisdom, statisticians and historians have marshaled facts against it. The titles of their books tell the story. The good news is the bad news is wrong. It's getting better all the time. The good old days, they were terrible. The case for rational optimism, the improving state of the world, the progress paradox, and most recently, Matt Ridley's The Rational Optimist and Charles Kenny's Getting Better. These defenses of modernity recount the trials of daily living before the advent of affluence and technology. Our ancestors, they remind us, were infested with lice and parasites and lived above cellars heaped with their own feces. Food was bland, monotonous, and intermittent. Healthcare consisted of the doctor's saw and the dentist's pliers. Both sexes labored from sunrise to sundown, whereupon they were plunged into darkness. Winter meant months of hunger, boredom, and gnawing loneliness in snowbound farmhouses. But it was not just mundane physical comforts that our recent ancestors did without. It was also the higher and nobler things in life, such as knowledge, beauty, and human connection. Until recently, most people never traveled more than a few miles from their place of birth. Everyone was ignorant of the vastness of the cosmos, the prehistory of civilization, the genealogy of living things, the genetic code, the microscopic world, and the constituents of matter and life. Musical recordings, affordable books, instant news of the world, reproductions of great art, and filmed dramas were inconceivable, let alone available in a tool that can fit in a shirt pocket. When children emigrated, their parents might never see them again, or hear their voices, or meet their grandchildren. And then there are modernity's gifts of life itself, the additional decades of existence, the mothers who live to see their newborns, the children who survived their first years on Earth. When I stroll through old New England graveyards, I am always struck by the abundance of tiny plots and poignant epitaphs. Elvina Maria died July 12, 1845, aged 4 years and 9 months. Forgive this tear, a parent weeps. 'Tis here the faded floweret sleeps. Even with all these reasons why no romantic would really step into a time machine, the nostalgic have always been able to pull out one moral card, the profusion of modern violence. At least, they say, our ancestors did not have to worry about muggings, school shootings, terrorist attacks, holocausts, world wars, killing fields, napalm, gulags, and nuclear annihilation. Surely no Boeing 747, no antibiotic, no iPod is worth the suffering that modern societies and their technologies can wreak. And here is where unsentimental history and statistical literacy can change our view of modernity. For they show that nostalgia for a peaceable past is the biggest delusion of all. We now know that native peoples, whose lives are so romanticized in today's children's books, had rates of death from warfare that were greater than those of our world wars. The romantic visions of medieval Europe omit the exquisitely crafted instruments of torture and are innocent of the 30-fold greater risk of murder in those times. The centuries for which people are nostalgic were times in which the wife of an adulterer could have her nose cut off. A 7-year-old could be hanged for stealing a petticoat. A prisoner's family could be charged for easement of irons. A witch could be sawn in half, and a sailor could be flogged to a pulp. The moral commonplaces of our age, such as that slavery, war, and torture are wrong, would have been seen as saccharine sentimentality, and our notion of universal human rights almost incoherent. Genocide and war crimes were absent from the historical record only because no one at the time thought they were a big deal. From the vantage point of almost 7 decades after the world wars and genocides of the first half of the 20th century, we see that they were not harbingers of worse to come, nor a new normal to which the world would grow inured, but a local high from which it would bumpily descend. And the ideologies behind them were not woven into modernity, but atavisms that ended up in the dustbin of history. The forces of modernity, reason, science, humanism, individual rights, have not, of course, pushed steadily in one direction, nor will they ever bring about a utopia or end the frictions and hurts that come with being human. But on top of all the benefits that modernity has brought us in health, experience, and knowledge, we can add its role in the reduction of violence. To writers who have noticed declines of violence, the sheer abundance of them, operating on so many scales of time and magnitude, has an aura of mystery. James Payne wrote of a temptation to allude to a higher power at work, of a process that seems almost magical. Robert Wright nearly succumbs to the temptation, wondering whether the decline of zero-sum competition is evidence of divinity, signs of a divinely imparted meaning, or a story with a cosmic author. I can easily resist the temptation, but agree that the multiplicity of data sets in which violence meanders downward is a puzzle worth pondering. What do we make of the impression that human history contains an arrow? Where is this arrow, we are entitled to wonder, and who posted it? And if the alignment of so many historical forces in a beneficial direction does not imply a divine sign painter, might it vindicate some notion of moral realism, that moral truths are out there somewhere for us to discover, just as we discover the truths of science and mathematics? My own view is that the pacifist's dilemma at least clarifies the mystery and shows how the non-random direction of history is rooted in an aspect of reality that informs our conceptions of morality and purpose. Our species was born into the dilemma because our ultimate interests are distinct, because our vulnerable bodies make us sitting ducks for exploitation, and because the enticements to being the exploiter rather than the exploited will sentence all sides to punishing conflict. Unilateral pacifism is a losing strategy, and joint peace is out of everyone's reach. These maddening contingencies are inherent in the mathematical structure of the payoffs, and in that sense, they are in the nature of reality. It is no wonder that the ancient Greeks blamed their wars on the caprice of the gods, or that the Hebrews and Christians appealed to a moralistic deity who might jigger the payoffs in the next world, and thereby change the perceived incentive structure in this one. Human nature, as evolution left it, provides motives like greed, fear, dominance, and lust that keep drawing us toward aggression. And though a major workaround, the threat of tit-for-tat vengeance has the potential to bring about cooperation if the game is repeated, in practice, it is miscalibrated by self-serving biases and often results in cycles of feuding rather than stable deterrence. But human nature also contains motives such as sympathy and self-control. It includes channels of communication such as language, and it is equipped with an open-ended system of combinatorial reasoning. When the system is refined in the crucible of debate and its products are accumulated through literacy and other forms of cultural memory, it can think up ways of changing the payoff structure. Not least among those tactics is the super-rational appeal to another abstract feature of reality, the interchangeability of perspectives, the non-specialness of our parochial vantage points, which corrodes the dilemma by blending the payoffs of the two antagonists. Only an inflated sense of our own importance could turn our desire to escape the pacifist's dilemma into a grand purpose of the cosmos. But the desire does seem to tap into contingencies of the world that are not exactly physical. And so it is different from the desires that were the mothers of other inventions, such as refined sugar or central heating. The maddening structure of a pacifist's dilemma is an abstract feature of reality. So is its most comprehensive solution, the interchangeability of perspectives, which is the principle behind the Golden Rule and its equivalents that have been rediscovered in so many moral traditions. Our cognitive processes have been struggling with these aspects of reality over the course of our history, just as they have struggled with the laws of logic and geometry. Though our escape from destructive contests is not a cosmic purpose, it is a human purpose. Defenders of religion have long claimed that in the absence of divine edicts, morality can never be grounded outside ourselves. People can pursue only selfish interests, perhaps tweaked by taste or fashion, and are sentenced to lives of relativism and nihilism. We can now appreciate why this line of argument is mistaken. Discovering earthly ways in which human beings can flourish, including stratagems to overcome the tragedy of the inherent appeal of aggression, should be purpose enough for anyone. It is a goal that is nobler than joining a celestial choir, melting into a cosmic spirit, or being reincarnated into a higher life form, because the goal can be justified to any fellow thinker rather than being inculcated to arbitrary factions by charisma, tradition, or force. And the data we have seen in this book show that it is a goal on which progress can be made, progress that is halting and incomplete, but unmistakable nonetheless. A final reflection. In writing this book, I have adopted a voice that is analytic and at times irreverent, because I believe the topic has inspired too much piety and not enough understanding. But at no point have I been unaware of the reality behind the numbers. To review the history of violence is to be repeatedly astounded by the cruelty and waste of it all, and at times to be overcome with anger, disgust, and immeasurable sadness. I know that behind the graphs, there is a young man who feels a stab of pain and watches the life drain slowly out of him, knowing he has been robbed of decades of existence. There is a victim of torture whose contents of consciousness have been replaced by unbearable agony, leaving room only for the desire that consciousness itself should cease. There is a woman who has learned that her husband, her father, and her brothers lie dead in a ditch, and who will soon fall into the hand of hot and forcing violation. It would be terrible enough if these ordeals befell one person, or 10, or 100. But the numbers are not in the hundreds or the thousands or even the millions, but in the hundreds of millions. An order of magnitude that the mind staggers to comprehend with deepening horror as it comes to realize just how much suffering has been inflicted by the naked ape upon its own kind. Yet, while this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, that species has also found ways to bring the numbers down and allow a greater and greater proportion of humanity to live in peace and die of natural causes. For all the tribulations in our lives, for all the troubles that remain in the world, the decline of violence is an accomplishment we can savor and an impetus to cherish the forces of civilization and enlightenment that made it possible. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, by Steven Pinker. Copyright 2011 by Steven Pinker. Performed by Arthur Morey. Directed by John Baker. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.